Diane, it's Sunday, 11:58 in the morning. I'm sending you the latest episode of Season 2 of Horror Vanguard's Twin Peaks Retrospective. I think you're going to get a kick out of this one.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Horror Vanguard's Twin Peaks Retrospective. I am Ash, one of the Kogos, and we are joined by Scout, John, a.k.a. the Liquor Guy's cat. How's it going, you two?
Yeah, good. We are doing pretty well. Scout is a big fan of Season 2 of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, we are now a this is like a guys on a couch personality driven podcast, but you and I are slowly leaving the show and being replaced by our cats.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, fortunately the cats are going to do less like terrible financial and dating advice. So I honestly think that's how we save that genre of podcasting.
I keep saying podcasting is so due for the kind of late VHS grift. Make a podcast for your cats that's just cats talking. We'll call it cat talk.
Cat talk. There you go. That's that would go so viral on TikTok. cats, I know that you're listening. Call us. We are happy to talk more about this idea.
Just give your cat your phone. They know what to do.
We are talking about, of course, episode 12 or 5 or 70. I don't know anymore. I don't know what number we're on, but we are talking about the Orchid's Curse.
This is going to get exciting. This is a spicy, high-octane episode. We have a shootout. We have the word schizophrenia being mentioned essentially every third line. We have like five separate ability discourses happening. This episode is we are cursed. We are the Orchid's Cursed now that we have watched this.
Yeah, the pace and the kind of the amount of stuff that's just being thrown into these episodes is definitely ramping up, I feel.
I have a ridiculous hot take about the amount of stuff that's happening, and this is like this is bordering on Tommy Wiseau levels of things just keep happening.
Yeah, stuff just keeps going on for some reason, and we're not really sure why.
Which only furthers my Tommy Wiseau as an American realist filmmaker. That's a take we'll get to eventually.
I think so.
we just spend the rest of the Twin Peaks retrospective talking
about the
room.
Where would you like to begin? I think we should begin with Cooper's fondness for yoga.
Yes. Okay. What do you have to say about this? Because his kind of fascinating, like not only his, but the show as a text fascination with iconography and subjects from the East, I find to be very interesting.
Yeah. So there's a real fondness for like things like transcendental meditation in a lot of David Lynch's work, and there's a real interest in this notion of like yogic discipline. I like that but again, even in the midst of all that, when people go, oh, the show is so weird, it's really goofy because it opens with Cooper talking about a weird dream he had.
Yes.
And he was doing it's a comedy bit where he goes, I dreamt I was eating a large tasteless gumdrop, and then he awoke and he's been chewing on one of his earplugs. and this is maybe my favorite thing about spending a lot of time with Twin Peaks, is that like this reputation of Lynch is like this, and I know in Season 2 he was far to a degree much less involved, but this reputation of like the Lynchian as like the dark and the strange and the sexually transgressive, David Lynch is just a goofy little guy. Right? He's just having fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is what makes David Lynch so at home with other figures in my mind that are similar, like John Waters or Divine or just like any of that. Like, these are just like absolute weirdos wrestling massive psychic concepts, dealing with tons of fun perversion, but also the massive weirdo part, that's probably the standout feature here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get into the big discourse then. Let's get into the big discourse. Let's get into the Twin Peaks as Deleuze Guattarian commentary on schizophrenia.
Womp, womp, womp.
The alarms go off and we're immediately surrounded by 1,000 angry leftists with massive books they want to throw at us. Okay, where would you like to kind of start with this? Because we have to talk about Harold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have to talk about Harold, the one-armed man. We have to talk about just fucking Leland, everybody. Jesus Christ.
Okay. There's a lot here.
There's a lot to unpack. So, Harold. Where do you want to start with this one? Because Harold features prominently in this episode. I think it's good to start with this character.
Okay, So Harold has made an offer to Donna, right? Which is to say that, like, he's going to include her in the living narrative of the living novel of Twin Peaks that he's working on, that he's responsible for, if he lets her read the diary. And there is, their relationship is like, they're sort of intrigued by each other, right? They're sort of intrigued by one another. And of course, Donna decides that they have to take the diary. What do you think of how this plays out?
So there's something that's really interesting that's going on between Harold, the one-armed man, and establishing psychic legitimacy.
Yes.
Right. So Harold has Laura Palmer's secret diary. Harold informs us and Donna that there's nothing in there that's going to help solve the murder. It's these are just some of Laura's secret thoughts. That's it. All that's in there is a mystery. There's nothing that's going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then we have the one-armed man, right, who, you know, we can go back to the Giant's Clue without chemicals. He points to talk about psychopharmacology and how that functions in a larger capitalistic context. And we could also talk about the fact that he is, and the almost classical Greek sense of the word, a schizophrenic, a person split in twain.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is really interesting here is when these characters are being pressed and when they're being questioned, you know, whoever is trying to establish this kind of like punitive legitimacy questions whether or not they are schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's essentially meaningless, right? Like, they're not asking a question with meaning. They're attempting to create a discursive category, right? They're not asking, like, what is the state of your psyche and how does that change how you perceive the world? You know, like, they don't care about the one-armed man. They don't care about Harold. When they're asking that, they're attempting to place Harold or the one-armed man into, like, these delegitimized psychic taxa so that they can then be oppressed by the state in some way. So then you can strap the one-armed man to a table for the rest of his life until you meet him. Then you can break into Harold's home and steal his stuff. If he's crazy, he has no rights and his meanings don't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this ties into how Leo is treated as well. Right. If you become...
Yes.
If you are suddenly... This is a kind of like very basic point and is played out in a lot of different socially constructed categories. But if you become something that can be placed outside of the category of the normative, however that is enforced in ensconced and kind of policed, then you are kind of robbed of any moral agency as well. Right. You don't get to be agential, right? This is exactly the point, because the discourse around schizophrenia and crime is about culpability and specifically responsibility. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens to Leo. Leo, who is now in, I suppose, what we would call a kind of coma of sorts. A vegetative state for now. Or I think coma is a better word. Yeah. He becomes a kind of puppet. And in fairness, the way that he gets treated, I'm not wild about. It's interesting what happens to Leo as another way in which, you know, the right outcome, the just outcome, is often a kind of predicate for, like, no actual justice, right? But really a new sort of punishment.
Yes, like, let's I think it's worth really unpacking what's going on with Leo, because Leo's a huge scumbag.
Oh, an awful person. Yeah.
Yeah, just an absolute monster of a human being, right? He abuses his partner. He is engaged in all the non-good kinds of crime. You know, he's not out there Robin Hooding. He's not out there supplying cannabis to consenting adults. He's doing murders.
Yes.
He's doing financial arsons.
Yeah.
He's not a fun guy.
No, he's not. He is a pretty unambiguously bad guy.
Yeah, it's safe to say we can call him bad. But I think you're absolutely right. What happens to him is incredibly complicated, and I think the person that the show is attempting to, or the show is effectively indicting here, is us, the viewer, because we kind of join Shelley and Bobby in their kind of like sick tormenting of the now comatose Leo.
But of course, Shelley only keeps him around because there's a health insurance policy. So she's kind of like very, she's both financially vulnerable and very dependent. And I think it's... Is it in Demons? Yes, I think it's in Demons.
I think it's in Demons.
Yeah, we find out just how kind of deep that goes and the kind of... But Bobby is interested in revenge, right? Bobby's interested in punishment, and you go, I kind of see it, but this doesn't bode well for you, Bobby.
like it's easy to sympathize with the kind of like libidinal desires here, right? Like the household libidinal economy of Shelley, Bobby, and Leo, why they're doing this to him.
Yeah.
Like this vindictive desire to punish, but like, you know, as we see in the court case that runs parallel to this, you can't punish Leo anymore. You know, like Leo isn't home to punish, right? This is like sentencing someone in absentia, right?
Yeah, he's not the one being so this is why I say it's like it has nothing to do with justice. Leo's not being punished here.
Yeah.
Right? Because as you pointed out, Leo is not really registering what's happening to him as punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some really interesting theories of justice around kind of like sloshing around in Twin Peaks. And again, it's this idea of like, you can't change anything without reciprocal recognition of the past and its various kinds of violence, right? You can't change anything. Oh yeah, I like in our notes you just mentioned the Cyborg Manifesto, and maybe you can explain why.
Okay, so there's a huge Donna Haraway call out in this episode. That's a bit, by the way. I don't think that's intentional in the slightest. But there's a character named Mr. Pinkle, who's another we have a lot of like fun walk on guys. Here in early season two, every episode gives us a new fun guy that just walks into the show. And Mr. Pinkle sells medical supplies, right? He is going to retrofit the Leo Shelley homestead with all of the equipment they need to take care of the now comatose Leo.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to hook them on the sale for some apparatus. And he says the outstanding line, "A woman is like a machine," which I only assume that was a complicated, if fumbled, reference to the Cyborg Manifesto.
Yeah.
And really interesting politics on gender and living cybernetics.
Yes, absolutely. Like, that's exactly what it has to be.
I assume that's what that was.
That's exactly what it has to be.
Okay, yeah. That couldn't just be a throwaway bit of misogyny. That had to be a... 3D chess left political theory commentary. But that does like, I really like his interactions with Shelley and Bobby and the Leo, right? Because Shelley and Bobby are like, oh, we've got this cash cow. We're going to get $5,000 a month from the health insurance payouts. And they never take a moment to sit down and think that, oh no, we're in America.
Yeah, it's like, Shelley and Bobby, you know where you live, right? You must know that is not happening.
That is getting hoovered up by every medical apparatus dealer in the tri-state area.
Which, again, without spoiling too much, is exactly what happens. I think the other thing... that we should kind of connect this to is the bail hearing. Because again, you know, you have like the arguments around Leo and like legal capacity, but what do you think about that hearing? And as I put it in the notes, how to avoid jail?
So this, I think for me, the thing that stands out here is a lot of what I talked about in the previous episode about American crime drama television. You know, because like watching this episode, I was just thinking a lot about your own comments on what is the genre of Twin Peaks? What kind of a show are we watching?
Yeah.
And when we get these crime drama moments, like I think about like Criminal Minds, NCIS, the kind of like, you know, like new like high watermarks for American crime fantasy or even true crime shows, right? It's heavily pro cop, heavily pro law enforcement. It is just is almost wall to wall propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And here we've got like this prosecutor trying to argue that Leo can stand trial. And Leo is comatose. There's no Leo there to stand trial.
Oh,
the judge is like, what?
Can we also talk about the cocktail that they all decide to drink?
Oh, yeah, yeah. What do you got? What do you got?
Mostly that just seems to be the worst drink in existence. And how many other like terrible fictional cocktails have you found?
I once went to a 3-day Twin Peaks season 3 The Return like episode premiere party.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many bad Twin Peaks themed cocktails. A lot of people have this bizarre temptation to make the fish in the percolator work as a cocktail.
Yeah.
And
okay, yeah,
you can't do it.
So this is the Black Yukon Sucker Punch. I was just looking up the the name for it. And
let's do some mixology here. How would I make one of these?
It almost pretty immediately kind of turns me off the recipe that I found, because it involves one of my least favorite things to put in a cocktail, which are egg whites. Don't think you should do it. I just don't think you should do it.
So I just pulled up because I agree with your statement completely. But also 2 ounces bourbon, 1 ounce sweet vermouth, preferably coffee infused, 1 teaspoon creme de cacao, and then blue whipped cream. You know what? We're never gonna make that. What? You had me for a second there.
And there's a line where there is this kind of argument about what justice is, where it's, they say, he is as deserving of a trial as this community is of a sense of revolution. Of resolution, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is what the trial is, right? The trial is not really an object for justice. It's a kind of narrative prosthesis. It's a way of trying to neatly resolve the contradictions and problems of the death of Laura Palmer without actually resolving them in all of their cosmic weirdness that they get into.
Which is incredibly damning of our real world lived condition, right? Like, if this is true in the goofy, mysterious, and sometimes spooky world of Twin Peaks, like, ooh, I got bad news. I got bad news
bad
about
news
the world in which we find ourselves.
Literally everybody else.
If you like fixing problems, you are not going to like this system that we have.
No, indeed. Because we have the system of global capital, which of course brings us to Mr. Tojimura.
Oh, listeners who have watched Beyond the Orchid's Curse and know the secret of Mr. Tojimura, we're going to hold off on that one until we get there.
Okay. We will do so.
Otherwise, that's all we'll talk about for like 3 or 4 episodes.
Okay, yeah, we'll keep our powder dry, as it were. what should we talk about instead? What should we move on to?
Well, I think there are interesting things about Mr. Tajamore that we can talk about before the big reveal, which will no doubt be that entire episode. But so we've already had this since season one, right? Like, Twin Peaks is, as much as it is focalized as like a local show of the Pacific Northwest and full of Pacific Northwest flair, it's also a show about global capitalism.
Yes. Yeah.
And how the kind of like international machinations of finance just completely railroad the lives of average people the world over. Because if this is happening, if the Ghostwood Project is affecting the local residents of Twin Peaks in ways that they can't articulate because they simply do not know, imagine what's going on with all of those Swedes.
I know they're Icelandic, aren't they?
Or Icelandic. I'm sorry. Sorry to our Swedish listeners out there in the audience. I know we are the 42nd most popular film and television podcast in Northern Europe.
Which, gotta apologize. It's pretty stiff competition because the media and culture criticism podcasts in Sweden, they're pretty good.
Fire, just pure paradoxically, they're pure fire, even though it's very cold.
again, we apologize to our Swedish listener, and we should move on.
Oh yes, fun abounds here in the town of Twin Peaks. So, it wouldn't be a Twin Peaks retrospective episode without having to talk about some kind of phallocentrism. So how do you feel about cigars?
Oh, man, Ben Horn and his enormous phallic cigar that he is constantly putting in his mouth. There is this... just checking some detail. Yeah, it's really just that the cigar is the symbol of power, right? You know, there's the old Freudian joke, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And you have to go, well, no, it isn't. It's never just a cigar because of everything that it represents.
Yes.
The way that the function of the cigar.
Absolutely. And I was going to say the cigar is least a cigar for someone who insists it is just a cigar.
Correct. Yeah, and what do you think then about Ben Horn, and perhaps we can think about him in relation to Audrey and Cooper in this episode and in the next episode as well?
So this episode, we're about to get into Cooper's daring rescue of Audrey in the gothic catacombs that is Canada, but Ben Horn is the perfect gothic patriarch. Hundreds of years of gothic fiction, and it wasn't until Frost and Lynch that this guy was really hammered out.
Yeah, thank you, Horace Walpole. Thank you, Anne Radcliffe. Thank you, Frost and Lynch.
But his focus on the cigar, and I think this is such an important feature of the classic gothic patriarch too, is not only are they this kind of, not only are they a patriarchal tyrant, but it is that patricentricity that effectively shuts off their ability to see and connect with the rest of the world around him. Mm-hmm. He literally does not know that he almost or did sexually assault his daughter, right? Because he was so bound up in his own patricentric logics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here he is like deep throating a cigar in a long and detailed shot for our amusement, while all of this is still happening, while a business that he ostensibly owns has imprisoned his daughter, literally.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there's this question really of like, this gets expressed most clearly in the stuff around the diary, but there's this question of like, do you really want to know what the ultimate secret is? Do you really want to have all of this stuff come out, you know, Ben Horn's relationship with Audrey, the real truth of what's in Laura's diary. And I think this is the show not only just commenting on its own storylines and its own kind of character motivations, but also the kind of central problem of genre television, which is the desire for the kind of tension between there's always more mystery that has to be unfolded, but at a certain point, things have to resolve.
Yes.
So what do you think about that? Particularly in the context of how this episode ends as well.
I was going to say there's a certain part of the ending of this episode that I think is a perfect example of like oh, you want your mysteries unraveled? Well, I will show you what an absence of satisfaction feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Cooper's daring rescue of Audrey Horne. You know, because Cooper and Sheriff Truman go to One-Eyed Jack's to rescue Audrey.
Cooper has finally found the note that Audrey left.
Yes. And so they're up there on an elite secret stealth mission. And you know, like there's a lot of good, like, you know, like kind of like spy action stuff that's happening there. There's a good shootout, you know, they rescue Audrey, and then right at the end, the bad guys get the drop on Coop. He's gunned down, you know, like it's curtains for our detective. And then Hawk shows up and like throws a knife through the dude. And I forget what he says, but it's something along the lines of "Waka waka, invite me to the party next time."
And then like a sick guitar riff kicks in.
Right. Yeah. And then there's an explosion in the background, and they jet ski away. But no, and I think that's such a good example of like here's this amazingly tense moment that they set up,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you know, Coop has just like, there's a lot of great tension in the rescue. They just make it through. Blackie is dead. You know, Jean Reno has escaped. There's so much like oh, who's around? Every, like they're splitting up at certain points. They're looking around corners. They're like, there's some party at One-Eyed Jack's going on that they're trying to slip through.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, right at the end, it's just, like, it's just, like, getting a bunch of cold water dumped on you, right? Like, it just, like, snuffs out all of the tension and the excitement with a little gag.
And, of course,
and it's
this the kind of the same thing happens to Donna and Maddie, but from the opposite point of view, right? Because they end up mm-hmm. in serious trouble right at the end. But it, once again,
mm-hmm.
there is no resolution for them. Because that's sort of, like, the show giving you the... giving you the hook of like the tune in next time for more of the incredible exploits.
Absolutely. And I think that this really fits with a lot of like Lynch's sensibilities as an artist, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like nothing ends. There is no resolution. You know, like we're not a book. You never turn the page. The chapter never ends. The story goes on forever. Every moment of you builds into the next. Every part of your past weaves into the future. You know, like you can never, you know, isolate parts of yourself. You can never truly cancel out something that you've been.
Mm-hmm.
And like Twin Peaks is like, okay, wrestle with that. So sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's important, other times it sucks. But it is in fact the way we exist in this world.
that's our exit line right there.
Twin Peaks.
That was a really good way of summing up.
Oh, thank you. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed our discussion of episode 12, The Orchid's Curse, and we'll be back next week for episode 13, Demons.
Diane, it is that we have more questions than we have answers. A new episode. Kick out of this one. If the long history of the reception of owls reveals one thing, it is that we have more questions than we have answers.